From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, impeachment talk on Capitol Hill.
We believe that the President of the United States is engaged in a cover-up.
I walk in to look at people that had just said that I was doing a cover-up. I don't do cover-ups.
Also today, Boston versus St. Louis is a Stanley Cup Final rematch 49 years in the making.
Bobby Orr, behind the net to Sanderson, Orr! Bobby Orr scores in the Boston Bruins!
And we'll talk with presidential candidate and mayor of Miramar, Florida, Wayne Messam, and take your calls.
Mayors get the job done. We don't have the luxury to shut down our governments. And America needs an individual who will look at the issues that are important to the American people with the sense of urgency of today.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Impeachment is the talk of Washington today as Democrats huddled to discuss whether and how to proceed. Some members of the Massachusetts delegation are leading the calls for President Trump's ouster. They include Senator Elizabeth Warren and Congressman Seth Moulton, both presidential candidates. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has been preaching restraint without taking impeachment off the table. Here she is today after Democrats gathered.
It was a very positive meeting, a respectful sharing of ideas, and I think very impressive presentation by our chairs. We do believe that it's important to follow the facts. We believe that no one is above the law, including the President of the United States, and we believe that the President of the United States is engaged in a cover-up.
So, are we getting closer to impeachment proceedings against President Trump? I spoke with House Democratic Caucus Vice Chair Catherine Clark moments ago and began with that question.
I think what it shows is that while our party may have some differences in timing and tactics, we are more committed than ever in making sure that we hold this president accountable. And as you can see from his actions today, he is so rattled and bristled by having the speaker call out his actions for what they are, a cover-up, trying to keep the White House and this administration's actions shrouded in secrecy, that he had a temper tantrum and refused to discuss the pressing issues of infrastructure of our country. Does he not care about rural broadband? Does he not care about helping address climate in coastal communities like we have in Massachusetts, clean air, clean water, repairing our bridges and tunnels? He is the president of the United States, and he needs to start once again, or actually for the first time, working for the American people and not obsessing over keeping his actions out of sight, secret, and covered up.
Yes, let's talk about that infrastructure a little bit, because there were actually supposed to be two major meetings in Washington today. After you Democrats had your caucus meeting, President Trump planned to discuss infrastructure with Speaker Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer at the White House. But he ended that gathering just 3 minutes in after hearing Pelosi's cover-up remark, and then he vented during an impromptu appearance in the Rose Garden.
Instead of walking in happily into a meeting, I walk into look at people that had just said that I was doing a cover-up. I don't do cover-ups.
The president went on to say that he can't work with Democrats who continue to investigate him, even on improving roads and bridges, which would seem, Congresswoman Clark, like a bipartisan goal. So what do you make of the president's response today?
You know, for over 200 years, Congress and the executive branch have been able to do both things, meet our constitutional responsibility for oversight and work for the American people and progress. And infrastructure has been cited by this president as one of those areas where he can work with Democrats to find solutions for families. We know the infrastructure needs are pressing in this country, and states need our help with federal funding and policies to make it work. And he is acting like a child. And as the president of the United States, it is simply not acceptable that he says, I'm not going to work on the substantive issues, the needs of families of this country, and that instead I'm just going to, you know, kick everyone out of my sandbox. That is the type of tantrum that we just shouldn't tolerate from a president. The Democrats have made significant progress on bills that are providing solutions for families at home, whether it's addressing climate, net neutrality, gun violence, reducing the cost of prescription drugs. Where is the president in reaching out and working with us to say, these are priorities that I campaigned on as well. Let me help you get them a vote in the Senate. That's what we're looking for. That's what presidential leadership means. And this president doesn't even seem to understand the basic requirements of his job.
But the president's supporters would surely blame Nancy Pelosi for ruining today's infrastructure meeting with her cover-up rhetoric. I mean, is there any validity to his contention that post-Mueller report, Democrats should back off their investigations and just focus on legislating, that it's really on them?
When we have a president who is reaching out to one of his attorneys, Don McGahn, who is now a private citizen, and saying, do not come and testify before, when he is bringing affirmative lawsuits to prevent us from receiving financial information, when he is also suing Deutsche Bank to make sure that we can never see that information, when he has instructed Treasury to not give us the tax returns that we are clearly entitled to, I don't know what other word to apply except for cover up. If this president, as he says, has nothing to hide, then let's get the facts out into the sunshine. And if that's what he claims, then the facts will back him up and we can move on. But that is not where we are with this president. He is trying to thwart us at every single turn. And I think cover up is the exact right word.
That was House Democratic Caucus Vice Chair Catherine Clark squeezing in some time with us before dashing off to a vote. And she's had a busy day. This morning, Clark issued an explosive report with a Republican colleague, Representative Hal Rogers of Kentucky. They allege that opioid maker Purdue Pharma corrupted the World Health Organization by influencing its prescribing guidelines. Though Clark and I didn't get to that news in our conversation, she talked about it with WBUR a little earlier.
We are going to look at every tool that we can use to draw attention to this, to correct the record, and make sure that patients are getting accurate information.
Purdue Pharma is responding, saying it, quote, strongly denies the claims in today's congressional report, which seeks to vilify the company through baseless allegations. The company goes on to say in a statement that it is deeply concerned about the impact of opioid abuse and addiction. The WHO says it has no response yet, but is reviewing the report in detail. All right, let's bring in Boston Globe national political reporter Jess Bidgood. She was listening in on our chat with Congresswoman Clark and is here for some additional reporting and analysis. Jess, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's begin with that meeting of House Democrats today. We heard Congresswoman Clark echoing Speaker Pelosi's cover-up talk without directly saying that President Trump, should be impeached. So based on what you've learned about today's meeting, is that rhetoric representative of where the party is right now?
Yes. I think across Capitol Hill among Democrats, there is a real sense of I think individual Democrats are conflicted over what to do here. As Clark was talking, she kind of described this balancing act that Democrats have between oversight and keeping an eye on the executive branch and trying to show the progress that they are attempting to make on the kitchen table issues, they call it, that they campaigned on, issues like health care and that kind of thing. There are some concerns among Democrats that impeachment, pushing impeachment, will crowd out their work on those issues. But there's a growing number of Democrats who are saying, look, we are asking the White House for information. We are asking witnesses to come and testify in front of us, and they're not doing it. And an impeachment inquiry is the way to move forward. So at today's meeting, various chairs of House committees kind of updated the caucus on where their investigations were at. And then Nancy Pelosi came out, talked a little bit about those updates and said what we're looking at here is a cover-up. But again, she stopped short of calling for an impeachment inquiry, even though earlier this week some members of her caucus were asking her to move toward an impeachment inquiry.
So, Jess, how do you see Nancy Pelosi handling those competing voices? You know, do you think that her cover-up language today is a sign that maybe she's moving a little bit closer to those people who were calling her to move toward impeachment? Or do you think that maybe that rhetoric is just to kind of appease them for now and she's holding the line on restraint?
Well, it's interesting. I think that her rhetoric has shifted in recent months. Back in March, she spoke with the Washington Post magazine, and she said, and she made quite clear that she was opposed to impeachment. She said that President Trump is simply just not worth it, that impeachment would be too divisive, and was too likely to rev up Trump's base, and was too likely ultimately to fail and die in a Republican-controlled Senate. In more recent weeks, though, as complaints about obstruction by the White House of Democrats' current investigations have been piling up, I think you've heard her acknowledge that frustration, and you've also heard her talk about things like self-impeachment by the president, and kind of nod to the idea that if that the president's conduct and the White House's conduct in the face of these investigations could ultimately amount to impeachment. She's not calling for an inquiry right now. She really is calling for restraint, saying let's let the facts lead us where they may. But I do think with this cover-up language, she's really working to justify the investigations they have, and I do think she's acknowledged the possibility that impeachment could be somewhere in the future.
Well, when you talk about the self-impeachment notion, it kind of gets at the idea that there's sort of two phases here, right? Because the Mueller report focused on campaign year activities and some early presidential term phases. And now it seems like Democrats are really getting irritated at sort of post-Mueller report actions, the unwillingness of the Trump administration to fully cooperate with ongoing oversight. So when Democrats talk about impeachable offenses, the ones who are in support of that right now, what evidence are they pointing to? Is it mostly this recent stuff, you know, the stuff about Don McGahn not testifying or Bill Barr not going to testify?
Yeah, that has become a huge piece of the Democrats' frustration here. And you saw that actually coming to the fore on Monday night when there was a series of meetings on Capitol Hill where some top Democrats began to really try to make the case to Pelosi that it's time to begin an impeachment inquiry. Some Democrats have described the Don McGahn's failure to show up and testify in front of Congress earlier this week as being the straw that broke the camel's back. David Cicilline of Rhode Island is among Democrats who earlier this week said to Pelosi, look, we have to begin. If he doesn't show up, we've got to begin an impeachment inquiry. And he did not, in fact, show up. So that has caused a huge amount of frustration among Democrats who say, look, we are trying to do our due diligence. We are trying to do your plan and continue with our investigations here, but we can't get anywhere because the White House won't provide us with any information.
But the White House would say, look, you don't need to keep doing these investigations. The Mueller report is out. And although parts are redacted, people can see most of it. Lawmakers can see a little bit more than the general public. So what do these Democrats hope to get out of additional testimony? Why are they calling these folks?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the Democrats' answer to that is that they are a separate and co-equal branch of Congress, and they have oversight authority, and they have to use it. They have to stand up for their branch of government. But it's interesting. The White House's strategy seems to be working in its favor. Trump has is essentially deploying a strategy where he's saying, look, either impeach me or don't. But he's not giving Democrats a lot of room to work in this kind of middle place where they're trying to be, where they do these investigations but stop short of either calling impeachment or opening an impeachment inquiry. I think Trump is trying to force them. He's trying to force their hand, and he's saying anything short of impeachment, I'm not going to provide you with the information you're looking for. So what are you going to do?
That's Boston Globe national political reporter Jess Bidgood. Jess, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, we want the cup, the Stanley Cup, of course. We'll talk sports. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
We know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's Wednesday, so let's take a few minutes to talk about the world of sports. And here with us to do it is Radio Boston's own Chris Siderick. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Callum.
So we've known for a while that the Bruins are going to be in the Stanley Cup Final. They've been sitting around waiting to find out who the opponent's going to be.
It's been brutal.
We finally know who it is. The St. Louis Blues finished off their Western Conference Final Series last night. How do these two teams stack up now when they go head-to-head beginning on Monday?
So it's really interesting. There's an old saying in baseball, momentum is only as good as your next starting pitcher. Hockey's kind of the opposite. Hockey is all about momentum and generating that intensity and energy. And you just said that the Bruins have been off for a while. The Blues, actually, it's a tale of two seasons for them. As of January 3rd, about halfway through the year, they were the worst team in the NHL. And they make a couple of changes. They fire their coach. They switch out their veteran goaltender, Jake Allen, for rookie Jordan Binnington. And ever since then, they've been on an incredible run, probably the hottest team in hockey. So they have an incredible momentum going in. Binnington's been great in net for them. So this is going to be a series with two great goaltenders. Tuukka Rask has been incredible for the Bruins throughout the playoffs as well. In terms of style, the Blues tend to play a physical style similar to the Bruins. So I think that actually plays to the Bruins' advantage. This is a team that really tends to struggle when they face kind of those faster, high talent and teams that are more about the skating and the stick handling. The big bruising teams, they tend to do well against. So I think that plays to their advantage. And really, it's going to come down to the compete level, those loose pucks in the corner. Who's going to have the most intensity? Who is going to put it all on the line and take it that extra mile? Bruins have home ice advantage throughout this, so that could be a big factor. But you mentioned it, the big break. It's really going to be interesting to see how that affects them going into the series.
So they got some old timers on these teams. I don't think any of them were alive the last time the Bruins and Blues met in the Stanley Cup Final. But there is some really compelling history between these two teams, Chris. I'm thinking about a moment that's commemorated in a statue outside of the Garden. Take a listen.
Bobby Orr behind the net to Sanderson. Orr! Bobby Orr! Scores from the Boston Bruins! Has won the Stanley Cup!
So what you can't see there, of course, is that iconic image of Bobby Orr flying through the air after the
one of the best images
cup clinching goal. It's commemorated in that statue, like I said. I had a signed photograph of it, Chris, on my childhood bedroom wall. This is a big moment in sports history, and this is a chance to see these two teams get together again.
Yeah, they had 49 years ago, 1970 Stanley Cup Finals, the Bruins and the Blues. The Bruins swept the Blues at that point. The Blues were a new expansion team, so they're on more even footing this time around. The Blues actually haven't been back to the Cup Finals since 1970, so you could tell they're going to be a hungry franchise. Their city is excited. Another interesting storyline between these two teams, Bruins' David Backes. He spent 10 years with the St. Louis Blues. He's seventh all-time in terms of points for their franchise. He spent five seasons as their captain, so he obviously has strong ties with St. Louis, the team, and the city.
So the Bruins are the favorite to win the Stanley Cup. What could possibly trip them up?
I really think it's that rest. It's going to be really interesting to see how they respond. They're going to have 10 full days off by the time Game 1 starts. It's the longest period of rest before a Stanley Cup Finals ever in the history of hockey.
Wow.
And so it's all going to come down to, can they bring back that momentum? Can they channel that intensity? And I really think the person who could be affected most by it is Tuukka Rask, the Bruins goaltender. He was incredible through the run so far. He was asked about how the layoff is going to affect that, if he's still going to be able to stay dialed in. And he said basically he's just trying to keep that kind of that calm, steady approach.
I think for me, I just, like I said, work hard when there's practice time and then take time off when there's days off. And that's about the only thing you can do.
It's been incredible watching him. He has really been very still. That's when you can tell he's dialed in, is when he's not moving much. Very much the opposite of Tim Thomas, who was the Bruins
right.
goalie in 2011. I know you know Calum, who would fly all over the place, skate halfway up the ice sometimes. Tuukka, when he is playing his best, is as still as can be. And he's been that way.
Zen Tuukka
absolutely.
In these playoffs. Yeah. But what about the other side, though? I mean, couldn't the rest help the Bruins in some ways? I mean, their captain, Zdeno Chara, missed the clinching game of the Eastern Conference Final because he's banged up with some undisclosed injury. Of course, they never tell us what it is.
Yeah, right.
But I assume that could be helpful for them. I mean, could there be an upside to this as well?
Yeah, it's possible. The Bruins center, Charlie Coyle, actually was asked that, and he said he thinks it could be a good thing for the team.
Been kind of constant go, go, go ever since we started, it seems like. So I think the rest, you know, bumps and bruises guys have, and time to rest and heal, and mentally, physically, I think that'll do us well. And to get some good practice time, we'll use that to our advantage and prep, and that's going to be good for us in the long run.
So it's possible, but as you mentioned, Chara's injury, that's really one of the only injuries they've had. They've been fairly healthy, so it's not as if they're going to get a ton of players back through this rest. And it's really the length of rest that's so concerning. If you look back through sweeps of conference finals going into the Stanley Cup finals, other than the 2010 Blackhawks, basically every team that has swept the semifinals and had this long rest period has either lost the cup finals or taken it to seven games. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
All right, let's get to the bottom line. I'm going to make you have a pick here, Chris. I mean, it seems like this is one of those Boston sports runs that we've enjoyed so many of lately, where just the C parts, the top teams get knocked out, the tomato cans that Dan Shaughnessy is always
right,
talking about
right.
for the Patriots. Are we going to be having another duck parade pretty soon?
So I think we are. I hate to jinx it, but I think we are. Vegas agrees. The Bruins are the favorites in the series. It is really interesting that you say that the top seeds have all been knocked out. This is the first time that the top four seeds in the tournament have ever been knocked out in the first round. And it's a little surprising. I think folks weren't sure that this core Bruins team, Brad Marchand, David Krejci, Zdeno Chara, Patrice Bergeron, all these guys who were around in 2011, there was a question of whether or not they could make another cup run. This is probably going to be close to, if not the last shot, with this core group of guys. So it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out.
All right. We'll be watching on Monday when they drop the puck at the Garden for Game 1. But in the meantime, let's talk about another one of our teams that has won a championship recently. Not even the most recent one, though, because we have so many.
Oh, it's so great to be in Boston.
It's so good. But so let's talk about the Red Sox. They got off to a really slow start. They began to turn it around. How are things going right now at Fenway?
So better. It's hard to be worse. They started 7-13, which is pretty bad, especially for the defending champs. They're at 25-23 now, so a little bit over 500. They've won a couple more games than they've lost. But the problem is that the Yankees have really kept pace with that, so they haven't been able to gain a lot of ground in the division. They're still 5.5 games back. And the Yankees have dealt with an incredible amount of injuries. So they seem to be the team to beat in the AL East. One of the bright spots for the Red Sox has been Michael Chavis, who was called up in April. He now leads the team in home runs and RBI. So that's great to see when you have young talent stepping forward.
He's been a pleasant surprise.
Absolutely.
And they've needed it with Dustin Pedroia missing more time.
Sure.
And Michael Chavis had a really sort of heartwarming and exciting moment at the ballpark the other night, right?
Yeah, it was like straight out of a movie. It was perfect. So Sunday night, the Red Sox, time to time, they'll bring in a guest announcer in the stadium. So 5-year-old Jackson Younger, his family was in from Pennsylvania to see a game. So he needs a little bit of prompting, but you can hear the excitement in his voice.
Nobody!
The second baseman.
Second baseman!
Number 23.
I'm 23!
Michael Chavis.
Michael Chavis!
So Chavis said afterwards he didn't know that was coming. So he hears the kid's voice, he looks up to the booth, he gives him a point, and then he steps up to the plate and first pitch.
Good looking haircut there. A high fly ball by Chavis. Forget about this one. It is gone and out of the ballpark.
So, and another point up to the booth to Jackson as Chavis crossed home plate. It really was that kind of Babe Ruth call your shot Hollywood moment.
Yeah, positively Ruthian, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. This is a guy who hit, I think he was hitting 250 in the minors before he came
Absolutely.
Up. So
and has been popped for a PED suspension, too, before. So.
Yeah, it was that thing, too, as well. I guess the last thing we're wondering is if the team has actually turned it around. Can they sustain this run? As you mentioned, it's going to be hard to catch the Yankees. Are we looking at just a wild card possibility this season?
I don't see how not. The Yankees what the Yankees have been able to do with the injuries they've had makes me think that they are going to be really tough to beat this year, which means the Red Sox could be in contention for one of those wild card spots. And this new format where the wild cards have to play a one game win or go home type series, it really could come down to just that play-in game.
And can you get your rotation lined up to get the pitcher you want there too? That's Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, thanks as always for the sports knowledge.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Cal.
Classical music has some tried-and-true favorites. Mozart's Requiem, Beethoven's Symphony No. 5, Vivaldi's The Four Seasons. Far less popular are works like Concerto in One Movement by the 20th-century composer Florence Price. But at Symphony Hall this week, Price is one of the overlooked voices in the American musical canon who will take center stage. WBUR arts reporter Amelia Mason tells us about a pair of concerts featuring the Boston Pops, curated by the musician and MacArthur Genius Grant recipient Rhiannon Giddens.
When Rhiannon Giddens sat down to curate a pair of concerts for the Boston Pops, the popular image of a classical composer was never far from her mind.
You hear composer and you think, like, Beethoven. Guy in a powdered wig at a piano furiously scribbling on manuscript paper. That's not the only image that a composer should bring up, you know, but that's kind of what we've said it is.
So when the Pops invited Giddens to put together a concert program, she decided to expand that image by focusing on underappreciated Black composers.
This idea of what African American culture has been able to do under great duress, what Black entertainers and creators have been able to do in a world that consistently said that they were no good, is very interesting to me. It's, you know, particularly the period of the 20s and the 30s.
Creators like Hazel Scott, a piano prodigy who dominated the jazz circuit in the 30s and 40s and became the first Black woman to host her own television variety show. Or composers like Samuel Coleridge Taylor, a turn of the 20th century composer whose work was celebrated in his day but never entered the classical canon. Giddens is well-suited to the project. Throughout her career, the singer and banjo player has made it her mission to disrupt widely accepted ideas about American music. She's best known for her work with the Carolina Chocolate Drops, a Grammy-winning all-Black string band that challenged the popular narrative of Southern string music as an exclusively white tradition.
Cornbread and butter beans and you across the table, eating them beans and making love as long as I am able.
Pops conductor Keith Lockhart says the orchestra's a good match for a program that upends ideas around what music belongs in the concert hall.
That's one of the things that is great with the Boston Pops, of course, is that we are not so genre-bound as, say, our parent organization, the BSO. I mean, we are not restricted to the classical canon.
It's an opportunity to draw attention to composers like Margaret Bonds, who's recognized for her collaborations with the poet Langston Hughes and her arrangements of spirituals, but less for her classical bona fides. Lockhart says it was common for 20th century Black classical composers to also work in more popular styles.
Because that was what they could actually get employed to do, because nobody was going to premiere their symphony. Somebody was going to premiere their musical in a Harlem theater just north of Broadway, but nobody was going to play their symphony.
Giddens says the mix of genres on the program offers a more expansive view of composition, in which an improviser, like Hazel Scott, has just as much claim to authorship as a classical composer, like Samuel Coleridge Taylor.
It's not just who do we consider a composer from a racial sense, but it's also just who do we consider a composer, period. I think that there's people who live with the music in their bodies, and there's people who live with the music in their heads and their hands, and I don't necessarily think one needs to be elevated over the other.
It may be strange to think of Symphony Hall as a place for challenging hierarchies, but Giddens believes it's as good a setting as any. As she sees it, the fundamental problem of American music touches all genres. In everything from bluegrass to classical to pop, Black contributions have been minimized, diverted from the mainstream narrative into their own less central story.
The cultural narrative we have is flawed. It just is. It's flawed and it's deliberate. Separation in culture and arts does nobody any favors except for the people in power. That's just it. So I feel like I'm in the business of challenging that narrative.
Challenging that narrative means reckoning with all that it leaves out. The voices that were discounted, the opportunities denied, the work that never came to fruition or was forgotten. It's a much more complicated, painful story than the one we've been led to believe. More fraught and more full.
That's WBUR arts reporter Amelia Mason. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll talk with presidential candidate and mayor of Miramar, Florida, Wayne Messam, and he'll take your calls. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Two dozen Democrats are running for president, but only one has a resume that sounds like this.
Touchdown, Wayne Messam! A lightning bolt.
That's Wayne Messam as a wide receiver for the great Florida State football teams of the 1990s. These days, he's the mayor of Miramar, Florida, and a candidate for the nation's highest office. He was in New Hampshire yesterday. Today, he was at two high schools here in Massachusetts, Watertown and Cambridge Ringin Latin. And he joins me now in studio. Mayor Wayne Messam, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, we'd like to hear from you during this segment as well. What issues are most important to you in the 2020 election? And what questions do you have for candidate Wayne Messam? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Mr. Mayor, I see you, of course, grinning as we relive the glory days from Florida State there. But one of the reasons I wanted to play some of that sound is partly bio, but some of it, too, is that, you know, as a scholarship football player at Florida State, you had, you know, your tuition and whatnot paid for. And I know that a big part of your platform as a presidential candidate now is to wipe away the student debt that so many other students accrue in college. Why is that a top priority for you?
Well, you know, when you contemplate the $1.5 trillion in outstanding student loan debt, it's really crippling a lot of the financial upward mobility of over 44 million Americans that is carrying that debt. You know, I had the fortunate opportunity to have a full ride at Florida State University, but I believe that you shouldn't have to be an outstanding football or collegiate athlete to be able to have a higher education at a quality university. One of the reasons why we're proposing this is because when you think about how it's really affecting average everyday Americans, especially homes and families that don't have the money to pay for high-cost tuition, most folks have to get a student loan to get their way through and to pay their way through college. But we're not just proposing this as a student loan debt forgiveness. It's actually an economic stimulus. We see that on average, loans are about $30,000 worth of debt, about $400 a month in payments. One out of five Americans are actually late in their payments. But when this debt is forgiven, it'll our analysis states that it'll be $80 to $100 billion to the GDP. Will create 1.5 million jobs, and it will free up $400 a month to perhaps for young professionals to perhaps buy that first home, perhaps start a business, or even invest in their retirement. So we see this as a moral issue because it's really a big deal. To get a high-paying job, you have to have a college education. But only the working class and middle-class Americans actually have to foot this debt.
And you're proposing to pay for this by rolling back the Republican tax cuts of 2017. There are plenty of people who hate those tax cuts, but some people like them, as you know, Mr. Mayor, and you might be raising taxes then on those people who are benefiting now. They're not going to be too happy about that. I mean, what do you say to those voters, especially the ones maybe who didn't go to college and say, why should my taxes go up to pay for other people's debt forgiveness?
Well, this is primarily targeted at the major corporations and the wealthiest of Americans that saw $2 trillion go back to them. This is not intended to put additional tax burdens on average everyday Americans. And that's what's been happening. You know, everyone, every time there's a bailout for multi-billion-dollar corporations as well as the wealthiest of Americans. So we want to look out for the average American. So it's not intended to put any additional burden on the average Americans. I'm fighting for them. It's really targeted to make sure that corporations realize that they are benefiting from a well-educated and qualified and trained society, because in fact they are requiring their workers to have these advanced degrees in higher education. But they're not really putting any skin in the game in this, but they get a chance to benefit from it.
Some of your fellow Democratic candidates also have debt forgiveness plans of some kind. One that we've paid a lot of attention to, obviously, comes from our own Senator Elizabeth Warren. She's proposing something different. She's proposing to forgive about $640 billion of student loan debt, so not the full $1.5 trillion that's outstanding that you're proposing. And she wants to use some other money instead to create a free college tuition and fee system at any state university in the country. So that's the direction she's going. Why did you go a different direction?
Well, it's not that I went but a different direction. I was the first candidate to propose this. So I've led in this issue.
But why not free college at the state? Why not free state college?
I do agree with that. I do support that. And I'm glad to see that other candidates are also putting forward their own plans. And I think it's a great thing because it's bringing this issue to the forefront. What I'm thinking about in terms of moving forward is to have corporations to pay their fair share. I'm thinking about perhaps implementing and the proposal states perhaps a small payroll tax that corporations would pay that would fund the federal government to be able to invest in free state or public universities, as well as some HBCUs that may be private, to help drive down the cost of college education, to perhaps put more money in to be available for Pell Grants, offers those students that need additional financial aid.
We're talking with presidential candidate and Miramar, Florida Mayor Wayne Messam. And we'd like to hear from you during the segment as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to ask you a little bit about climate change as well, Mr. Mayor. I know this is a top priority for you as well. You're a business owner. You and your wife have a construction business, and you describe it as a climate-conscious business. How do you see that sort of balance between public sector initiatives that you would be proposing in government versus what the private sector should be doing, like the businesses that you're running?
Well, you know, we're all in this together. Whether it's private or public, this is the same earth. We have to be good stewards. You know, I became a LEED accredited professional, which is the highest designation that an individual can get in terms of sustainable construction, way back in 2009, before I even got into elected office. So I'm not just bringing this issue up as a candidate for president. I've walked this walk since in my professional life since 2009. And the reason why I'm so intrigued about our environment is because we have to ensure that we have an environment for future generations to come. But as a business owner, that's one of the unique perspectives I bring to this dynamic. I don't just make proposals without thinking about the consequences it has on businesses. In fact, I'm more concerned about the small businesses because those are the businesses that don't typically get the breaks that the larger corporations get. So being an advocate for small business proposals and initiatives while being able to have that balance as a public service, hey, listen, I own a business. I love to make money. But yet, I'm a mayor that passed the living wage in my city. So I definitely understand what it is that we are all in the same boat, and we can be an America that looks out for everyone.
So how about this Green New Deal that is so buzzy in the Democratic Party? We've heard you say elsewhere that you support the urgency behind that idea, that you support the end goal of that proposal. That sounds a little bit short of a full endorsement, though. Are you totally on board with the Green New Deal, or maybe you think it's a little bit too ambitious?
Well, I think the Green New Deal is a great proposal that has really brought the issue of climate change to the forefront, as well as some of the economic benefits of it. One of the challenges with the Green New Deal is that it's so vast. the average person can't really wrap their hands around what it is. I think some folks are taking my comments out of context in terms of that my support of the end goal and the urgency. So I do support the Green New Deal. I would look to make my own specific proposal that would kind of break it down where it's in bite-sized pieces where folks can wrap their hand around many goals that reach that accumulate to the overall goal. Because I do realize that you have a split Congress. And I do realize that whenever you're making massive changes, that it can get caught up in demagoguery and the political process. So I think by us putting manageable sections of this end goal and the urgency that we can begin to move these pieces so that we can get to the ultimate goal.
I see. So you're not talking about one whole all or nothing bill. You'd be willing to break it up into smaller legislative bites that maybe you could get a few of them through a split Congress.
That is an option. It's not if we can get an overall package through, then fine. But if there's no pathway politically, we have to be smart enough to get our wins where we can get our wins. And I think that's one of the problems with Washington. Everyone backs in their corner and it's my way or the highway without any compromise or any way to perhaps to get in some goals instead of having nothing at all.
Right. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK is the number to join our conversation with presidential candidate Wayne Messam. Tim is in Belmont. Tim, what are you wondering?
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call. It's a real pleasure and privilege. I was just calling. I have a question for candidate Messam. What does he think that the best strategy to take down and remove the current occupant from the White House is, and how in the 24 candidate field that's currently present for the primary, what does he think the best message is going to be for whoever, whether that's him or another candidate? What does he think the best message is going to be in the general to give Democrats the chance to actually win?
Tim, thanks for the ring. So how about it, Mr. Mayor? You hear, so we've been talking policy, but there's sort of the practical things that voters are wondering. How are you going to win?
What I can say is there's very few presidents that have been elected without inspiring a great number of individuals. It has to be more than just beat Trump. We have to bring inspiration back to the American people. We have to find those topics and those issues that really motivate folks to come out. You know, a lot of the candidates that are running for the Democratic nomination are talking about getting back to some form of normalcy. I disagree with that wholeheartedly because before President Trump got into office, normalcy wasn't working for average Americans anyway. That is why he got elected. He made promises, empty promises that he's not been able to maintain. So I want to be my candidacy is going to be based upon reaching everyday issues like forgiving student loan debt, like creating entrepreneurs, putting out an infrastructure plan that will make our country more resilient, put people to work while addressing climate action, taking climate action. I think those are the things that people are looking for on those kitchen table issues in terms of why do I have to work 2 and 3 jobs just to make ends meet? You know, these are the types of things that we have to have a candidate that's going to say, you know what, this we need to pass a living wage nationwide so that folks can be able to take care of their families.
As you know, when it comes to beating Trump, there's a couple leading schools of thought. One is that you sort of run to the left and maybe try to grow the pie or try to get more turnout of people maybe who haven't voted in previous elections. Another is to reach across the aisle and try to convince some of those people in the middle or maybe bring over some of those people who voted for Trump 4 years ago. And as I've been thinking about that, I'm reminded that, of course, you played for the legendary coach Bobby Bowden at Florida State. And folks might remember that he campaigned for Donald Trump in 2016. So you clearly have some experience, you know, building relationships and working with people who see the world differently from the way you do. So is there anything you can take from that into running for president?
Well, in terms of the Democratic nomination, I have to show progressives that I have progressive ideas. But as a mayor, not only do I show my progressive ideas, I can talk about my actual experience in passing legislation and ordinances and laws in the city of Miramar, like passing a living wage, suing the state of Florida so that we can have more of a say in gun control in our city. But in terms of a general election, you know, being a mayor is a nonpartisan and environment. So we deal with individuals who are Republican, no party affiliate, and Democrats. Mayors are goal and solution oriented. And as long as we are serving and meeting the needs of the American people, that will be the direction that I would take as president of the United States.
All right. Norlene is calling from Alston. Norlene, what are you wondering?
Yes, I'm wondering, how is this candidate is going to foster collaboration to get things done that the people really want?
Norlene, thanks for the ring. So there's that bipartisanship question that I was sort of hinting at. How do you reach across the aisle and get those Bobby Bowdens of the world on your side if you're in Washington?
Well, the thing is that we have to come to terms on the issues that binds us all together. You know, a very controversial topic is health care. There's a lot of talk about Medicare for all and how do we ensure all Americans. I think health care is a matter of civil rights, as an example. I think in a perfect world that we should have a single payer process. But if we really look at it practically, if we take a split Congress that we have right now, moving from where we are right now with the Affordable Health Care Act, the health care system that we have, to a universal health care program, it's like Armageddon to get something like that passed in today's Congress. I feel that we can expand Medicare and Medicaid to cover Americans that don't have existing coverage, but I also believe in choice. If you have a private insurance or an employer-provided insurance plan that you want to keep, that you should be able to keep that. But if you're not happy with that employer-provided plan or a private plan, that you can bring your premiums over to the government plan. But I think that if the end goal is to get everyone insurance coverage, then whether Republicans agree with the principle and Democrats agree with the principle, at the end of the day, if everyone has good quality health care, does it really matter if it's single payer or if it's a combination as we reach to the end goal of a single-payer process? And that'll be the approach I would take.
Sure. But so as the mechanism goes, though, does that mean sort of restoring the individual mandate that was originally part of the ACA? Or maybe it's a public option, which some people wanted in the original ACA but was not actually there?
I think to some degree, you're going to have some public option. You're going to have this country stating and having the political will that we as Americans believe that individuals in this country should have health care and we are willing to pay for it. Just like we don't think twice about funding our transportation system. We don't see driving on our interstates as public welfare but we all pay into that process because we value transportation and commerce and the importance of that. The same thing for healthcare. So there will have to be some investment from a public standpoint in terms of paying for quality healthcare in this country.
1-800-423-8255 is the number if you'd like to join our conversation with presidential candidate Wayne Messam. And since we're talking about health care, Megan is calling from Andover with a health care related question. What are you wondering, Megan?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I would like to ask the candidate, given the recent attack on women's reproductive rights that have been high profile by many states recently, how would the candidate as president defend and protect a woman's right to choose and reproductive freedom?
Go ahead, Mr. Mayor.
Thanks for your question. I believe that Roe v. Wade is settled law, and as president, I would vigorously defend that precedent. I think that it's a concerted effort in a lot of conservative states to test Roe v. Wade with the new complexion of the U.S. Supreme Court. That is why you are seeing a variety of state statutes and legislation being passed in state legislatures and assemblies to specifically push these legislations through the federal appellate process so that it can land at the Supreme Court to see if this new conservative-leaning Supreme Court will overturn Roe v. Wade. And then that is why you're seeing what is happening. In fact, it's a travesty when you think that 99% of abortions happen within 27 weeks of pregnancy. This is not an alarming issue in terms of late-term abortions. And I think it's already difficult enough for a woman and her family and her healthcare professional to come to decision to abort a pregnancy. That is tough enough in of itself. To have primarily men to make legislations to dictate and regulate a woman's right to reproductive decisions.
You say you want to protect it, but if you get to the White House, you'll be inheriting this conservative-leaning court that you were just describing. So does that mean you're going to push for new legislation that would more explicitly explicitly enshrine the precedent set by Roe?
Well, if you have to ratify it, you have to ensure that it's protected. You need to make sure you have a Justice Department and Attorney General that will protect our precedent and not necessarily pick and choose, because, you know, it really matters in terms of how this government, you know, protects our settled law. But I would want to definitely support any measure that will protect a woman's right to choose. And obviously, we are where we are in terms of where our Supreme Court is. And I would be, you know, I would appoint justices that recognize that Roe v. Wade is settled law in this country.
In the moments we have left, we began the show by speaking with Congresswoman Catherine Clark about the ongoing impeachment debate on Capitol Hill. Where do you come down on that? I mean, is that where Democrats should be focusing right now, or should they just put their heads down, legislate, and try to beat this president at the ballot box?
Well, Congress has their constitutional responsibility of oversight. They cannot ignore that. As a candidate, I'm focused on the issues. However, Congress has to do their job. The available redacted Mueller report and the evidence that is coming out of that report seems that there was obstruction of justice. And I think the Congress should do what they need to do to settle and answer that question and provide the American people the oversight. And that's their constitutional duty. That's not an option. However, I don't subscribe to the thought that it's either or. There is no reason why Congress cannot focus on the issues that are important to the American people while doing their job of oversight in this country.
That's Wayne Messam. He's the mayor of Miramar, Florida, and a candidate for president of the United States. Mr. Mayor, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.